Today, I am speaking with San Francisco Bay Area architect Richard Gage, member of the American Institute of Architects and the founder and former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So, Richard, it's a pleasure to speak with you today.
You too, Jay. It's an honor to be here with you.
So, I understand you have a presentation prepared to take people through your research and investigations over the years. And if we do have time afterwards, perhaps we can finish off with a few questions. I'll no doubt be taking some notes as you go through the presentation, but I want to give you as much time as you need to present your work without any interruption first. And then, if there's some time afterwards, we can do a bit of a Q&A.
You got it. I'm looking forward to that part. That's my favorite.
Fantastic.
We got to see how this information sunk in, or did it just glide over? So it takes a lot of courage to even be willing to look at this stuff. I don't know where you were or what you were thinking when you first heard some of this, Jay, but I was in shock. I'm a flag-waving Reagan Republican, right? I wanted to go into Afghanistan and Iraq and get those bastards who did this to us. It turned my world upside down. This was like 5 years after 9/11, and I'm one of 90,000 members of the American Institute of Architects. For instance, we didn't get one bulletin on this, the third worst structural failure in modern history. Building 7 wasn't hit by a plane, right? But it went down anyway. I mean, this should have been the most studied structural failure ever. And so here it is, half the height of the Twin Towers. They were the tallest buildings in the world at the time they were built. But it just this collapse of this building got swept under the rug. This would be the tallest building in most of our states. And yet, just most still today, most architects and engineers know nothing about it. It's just been erased from history. It was about a football field in length away from the Twin Towers. Here it is, in fact, standing just fine after the towers came down. A few of the structural elements from the Twin Towers hit it. There was some damage. But NIST says this is not a significant factor in the building's collapse. Well, we'll find out what was. But let's look at the collapse first. Here at 5:20, about 7 hours after the towers had come down, this building, which had some fires in it, we'll look at those, does this. First, the east penthouse drops in an isolated event 7 seconds before the global collapse, which does this. You ever seen that before, Jay? No. And I haven't seen a building do that by fire either, but we do have a frame of reference, like the old hotels in Las Vegas when they come down. We'll take a look at those in a moment. But there was a report on this building from NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And they spent 2 years developing their 1,000-page report on this. And what did they come up with? Congress had tasked them to develop an explanation to the American people of how this building came down. Here it is.
What we found was that uncontrolled building fires caused an extraordinary event. The collapse of World Trade Center 7 was primarily due to fire.
Fires. Okay, well, let's look at those fires. Here they are. They're few, they're small, and they're fairly scattered throughout the building, as we can see. And so some say these fires were raging. Well, in a particular area, they were raging, and that's the area of interest by NIST in the northeast corner. But these fires moved on from that area to the west. So they could not have been involved in expanding these long span beams, as NIST claims in their initiation collapse theory, because they had burned out in that area and moved toward the west. In fact, they were completely burned out by the time the building collapsed. So, nevertheless, NIST, in their effort to explain this, the cause of this collapse due to fires, provided a fire simulation to American people. And they show these fires burning for over an hour and a half, in fact, almost all afternoon in this northeast area, even while the photographs reveal that those fires were not, in fact, burning in that area at all. They had moved on to the right side, the west side, on that floor of interest, the 12th floor, where NIST developed its collapse initiation theory. So there's a number of questions. In fact, for every component of NIST's theory, there are serious questions. In fact, not one of them could have even ever happened. And we go into this in detail in our webinar, 9/11, An Architect's Guide, which is available on our website, richardgage911.org. Well, let's look at some fires that have burned in Type 1 fire-resistive buildings. These are steel frame fireproofed structures that have never, in fact, come down in history, even though they burned overall 3.5 hours in Los Angeles, 18 hours in Philadelphia, 17 hours in Venezuela. But there's only fuel enough in one area of the building to burn 20 or 30 minutes. And this is even acknowledged by NIST. So these are overall burn lengths, which is very important because these buildings are 3 hour fire protected on the columns and 2 hour fire protected on the beams. So a half an hour of fire in a given area is not going to do the kind of damage that can bring these buildings down and never has, not even after 9/11, where we have fully engulfed skyscrapers. Type 1, again, fire-resistive construction. Well, if it's not fire that brought those buildings, that building down, what could it have been? Let's compare Building 7 on the right to a known controlled demolition on the left. Is there any similarity? Yeah. Is there enough similarity to warrant an investigation into the possible use of explosives, especially since it looks exactly like a controlled demolition, especially since fire, the official cause of this building's collapse, has never in history brought down a steel frame fire protected structure. So let's take a look at controlled demolition and see if Building 7 has any of these features, beginning with a sudden onset of destruction, typical of controlled demolitions. In fact, let's listen to Dan Rather explain this using his intuition as to what's going on here that afternoon.
What you're seeing are high shots. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
Amazing,
incredible, pick your word. For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
What? Deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down? Dan's using his intuition here, right? As we all should. I mean, we have a frame of reference for this kind of collapse. So, it should be inherent, implicit, to examine this hypothesis before any other hypothesis. In fact, well, Dan has never repeated those words, and in fact, this building, with two exceptions, has never been shown on public television, though it should have been the most remarkable unexpected collapse in history. And we'll talk about the expectations of the firefighters in a moment. But we have another feature. Is there a straight down symmetrical collapse into the building's footprint? Let's look from West Street. Yeah, pretty straight down, pretty symmetrical. How do you do that? Well, they have to take out all of the core columns at once within a split second of each other, followed about a second later by the perimeter columns. This is about 80 columns. Otherwise, the building will begin to tip over if there's any asymmetry in taking out the structure. Were these fires capable of that symmetry? It's pretty clear that they were not. In fact, again, all the columns had to have been taken out at once. Could those fires do that? No. And in fact, if you don't take out all those columns at once, you can get some really strange things happening in controlled demolitions that fail, like this and like this, where it just stops and halts and it's in that position, and somebody's got to go back into that building and set up those explosives again or fix them. Natural collapses.
If the steel had weakened, there would have been asymmetrical sagging. It would have been gradual, and you wouldn't have had enough dynamic.
So you might have seen something like that. Well, how fast is the building coming down? Physicists like David Chandler have clocked this, and they've found that indeed it comes down at free fall. Now, that's as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky. That means that not one of those columns, 80 of them, gave any resistance for at least a third of this building's 7-second collapse. Now, NIST actually acknowledged this in their final report after being publicly embarrassed by members of AE 9/11 Truth, engineers particularly. So this is acknowledged, but the implications of it are not. What are the implications? Again, that not one of those columns gave any resistance. Well, where did they go? I mean, how did they all just disappear at once? By these fires? We don't think so. Not plausible. Feature number 5, do we have the total dismemberment of the structural steel system? Yeah. This is a 47-story moment-resisting and braced frame structure. And it falls, though, like a house of cards into a pile 6 stories tall, indicating that all of those columns and beams must have been severed. We have buildings that have fallen due to natural causes, in this case by earthquakes. The columns and beams are not severed one from another. The concrete is not pulverized to a fine powder. Can those fires accomplish what we saw in Building 7? No. So what could have? Well, maybe explosives. Let's look and see if there are witnesses of explosions prior to this building coming down. Here's Daryl, a medical student, interviewed that evening.
We were watching the building, actually, because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire, and you know, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was, it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out, and, you know, it was horrifying. Then, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that, and we saw the building crash down all the way to the ground.
Okay, that's helpful. How about Kevin McFadden, a former Air Force medic, as a first responder on the scene that evening?
You heard explosions, like boom. It's like a distinct sound. It's not like when in compression, like boom, 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 like floors that were dropping and collapsing. This was boom, and like you felt a rumble in the ground, like almost like you wanted to grab onto something. That, to me, I knew that was an explosion. There was no doubt in my mind.
And this gentleman who saw flashes.
I was standing like 2 blocks away, and all of a sudden I just seen a big flash. And then I seen the building coming down, and I just seen people just running everywhere, chaotic-like.
And this first responder, Captain Richard Patterson.
1-7 let go as well, and was a series of concussive explosions.
And this gentleman, Patrick Dillon, first responder.
I remember feeling that, like it was like freight trains underneath the earth shaking the earth, even shaking me. That's when we all saw Building 7 crumple in the middle, like way up at the top. It buckled. It buckled and then dropped.
So this is very helpful. If this was engineered in advance with explosives, or as we'll see in a moment, incendiaries, there would be people who would know about it in advance, such as Deputy Chief Nick Visconti, who says, hey, we're moving the command post over this way. That building's coming down. And here goes 7. And Chief Hayden also. Chief Hayden had important testimony.
Well, we had our special operations people set up surveying instruments to monitor and see if there was any movement of the.
Chief Hayden says, oh, here we go. Could, if we allowed it to burn, could we anticipate a collapse, and how soon? Because he's talking to an engineer who had put a transit on the building, and the engineer tells him, well, in its current state, you have about 5 hours. Wait a minute. No steel frame fire protected structure has come down in history. High rises in particular, due to fire. This building wasn't hit by a plane. How does he know it's going to come down in 5 hours? Turns out he was right on the money, Chief Hayden says. Of course, this prediction could only have been made with foreknowledge. We do not get the name of the engineer. It remains anonymous.
Well, we had our special operations people set up surveying instruments to monitor and see if there was any movement of the building. We're concerned of the possibility of collapse of the building. And we had a discussion with one particular engineer there, and we asked him if we allowed it to burn, could we anticipate a collapse, and if so, how soon? And it turned out that he was pretty much right on the money, that he said in his current state about you have about 5 hours.
So really revealing information, as are these, as is the testimony from these mysterious construction workers walking away from Building 7, hearing an explosion over their shoulder, looking back at the building, and then looking straight into the CNN camera and saying this.
Keep your eye on that building. It's coming down. The building is about to blow up. Moving back.
Back here.
All right, guys. We are looking back. It's a building about to blow up. Flame, debris coming down.
The building is about to blow up. Flame and debris coming down. How do they know the building is about to blow up? It has a few small fires in it. Let's jump back to Patrick Dillon, first responder, who had an interesting experience in the lobby of Building 7 before it came down.
And he pointed to what turned out to be the entrance to Building 7's lobby. He said, go in there, take a break. There's other guys in there, like that. And that's what I did. I finished coming down off the pile and climbed over the wreckage of Vesey. And went into those revolving doors and just kind of fell on the floor. There were other guys in there doing the same thing I was, just shaking their heads and spitting out poison and trying to get their lungs back together again, as I was. And I was on the floor. These battalion chiefs come in through the revolving doors. There was three of them. They had the white helmets. I didn't get any IDs off them, but as soon as they stepped inside, what stepped in behind them were these two people in black with black ski masks on, and Uzis, and the Uzis were hanging off their necks, and I don't know what they were or who they were, but the battalion chief started yelling at us, right, ordering us to get out of this building. They're going to pull the building, everybody out now. And they ordered us back out.
Well, we wonder what that means, but the testimony is corroborated in part by Captain Richard Patterson, first responder.
So he and I made our way over to the entrance of the building. Before we arrived there, There was a construction worker who happened to be... He emerged from the dust cloud and walked past the chief and I. And he said he had overheard the chief's comment. And he paused and said, that'll be coming down around 5 o'clock. We part ways, we arrive at 7, and there were two paramilitarily clad men with black rifles, sunglasses. And as we approached the entrance, they closed ranks and said, one of them said, this building has been secured, which is odd. Because in my experience in the FDNY, anybody preventing access to the fire department in the event of a fire, that's a criminal act. The chief and I were not in a position to argue the point, given the inequality in weaponry present.
So two instances there from first responders with foreknowledge. Well, how about this piece of foreknowledge from, once again, Kevin McPadden, who had previously, we had heard previously talk about explosions, but before that, he and others were held back a certain distance away from Building 7, and he's listening to a radio held in the hand of what he believed was a Red Cross worker, and this is what he's hearing.
At the last few seconds, he took his hand off, and you heard 3, 2, 1.
What? Do fires bring buildings down by countdowns? What's really going on here? And how did the BBC announce the collapse of this building 20 minutes before it happened?
I was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing, and indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened. During this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy.
Sketchy indeed. Announcing the collapse of a building 20 minutes before it's happened, when it has never happened in history. They apologize for this grievous error, citing the confusing events of the day. What does this make them psychic? But not to be outdone, CNN announces the collapse of a 50-story building at 11:07 that morning.
In New York, Alan Dodds Frank joins us on the phone in Lower Manhattan. Alan?
Alan, just 2 or 3 minutes ago, there was yet another collapse or explosion. I'm now out of sight. A good Samaritan has taken me in on Duane Street. But at 10:45, there was another collapse or explosion following the 10:30 collapse of the second tower. And a firefighter who rushed by us estimated that 50 stories went down. The street filled with smoke. It was like a fire, forest fire roaring down a canyon. Now, as I think Patty Sabgan and others have told you, all of
no other 50-story building went down. There was no other building that went down. There were some buildings that were badly damaged. But had this building gone down at that time, we would not even have any video of it. It would have been completely obscured by the massive dust cloud, powdered concrete, as it turns out, released when the Twin Towers came down. So some 9/11 truth community researchers speculate that this building was supposed to go down at that time in the morning under the cover of this massive dust cloud, and that those mysterious construction workers walking away from Building 7, hearing the explosion over their shoulder and telling everybody that building's coming down, flame and debris blowing up, and that they were fixing the dud that didn't go off at 11:07 or whatever, 11 o'clock, or at the time the towers went down earlier, 9:30 and 10. So we then turn our attention to the owner of the building. Maybe he knew something. Well, a year later, he's on PBS TV, America Rebuilds program, talking about Building 7, and this is what he says.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. And I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull. And then we watched the building collapse.
Pulling a building is not something fire department personnel do. They put out fires. And pulling a building is a term used in the controlled demolition industry. So he's saying maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made the decision. No, they don't make the decision to pull. He says, well, no, I didn't mean the firefighters. He comes back later and explains this. I meant pull the firefighters out of the building. Well, the firefighters were in fact kept from putting out the fire. They were told it was going to come down on its own. So they couldn't have been pulled. And you don't say pull it when you're talking about pulling firefighters out of the building. There were no firefighting efforts taken to put out this building from both FEMA and NIST. Talk about that. In fact, they say there was a lack of water flow. Well, that's not true either. It turns out that the water flow to the World Trade Center goes right past World Trade Center 7 to get to the Twin Towers. The water comes from the north. Building 7 is on the north side of the World Trade Center complex. And it's said NIST by NIST, while the fires in other buildings were actively fought by firefighters to the extent possible, WTC 7, no efforts were made to fight the fires because of a lack of water supply. Well, that's ludicrous. It turns out that there's backup fire pumps to provide plenty of pressure anyway to the fires. And it turns out that these standpipes were fully charged, as noted by who? Chief Pete Hayden. Was there water for fire extinguishing? Yes. And so he's sharing that. And in fact, the videos show that there was water for extinguishing. And the sprinklers are shown active on the right side there. So we have a whole series of made up lies. In fact, the hose for the firefighting is charged heading from this fire truck from the water supply in the area. Well, what do the experts say? Here's one of the top controlled demolition experts.
Danny Jowenko is the expert on this in Europe. What did he say?
Dit is controlled demolition. Zeker weten. Zeker weten. Er is nagesprongen. Dit is in opdracht gebeurd. Het heeft een team gedaan van experts.
Okay, what else did the experts say then besides that? Well, to 36 structural engineers are among those signed on to the petition demanding a new investigation. The petition is on our website, Richard Gage 911. And this one, Kamal Obaid, a structural engineer, says a localized failure in a steel frame building like WTC 7 cannot cause a catastrophic collapse like a house of cards without a simultaneous and patterned loss of several of its columns at key locations within the building. What does that sound like? Well, it's backed up by the University of Alaska, who did a four-year study. One of the top forensic structural engineers in the country, Professor Leroy Hulsey and his team of PhDs studied this because they said, gosh, if that building went down by fire, you know, there are hundreds of similarly designed buildings that we have to retrofit because we can't have this happening again. Well, he does the study comparing all the features that NIST had in their finite element analysis. And he finds that the building did not behave at all like NIST said it behaved. In fact, he found that the video of the collapse shows a free fall collapse, and which is reproduced by the University of Alaska, whereas the NIST finite element analysis tries to back engineer their model by taking out 400 structural steel connections per second, but it's still, not only does it not fall at free fall, they have to stop the global collapse after just 2 seconds because it begins to tip over. And they didn't want people to see that. So they had actually 7 years to produce this model and this final report. I said 2 years earlier. I meant 7 years. The final report for Building 7 came out in 2008 in August. And this is what they produced on the right. So the University of Alaska, who is doing the job here that NIST was tasked by Congress but failed miserably, what did the UAF find? Fire did not cause the collapse of Building 7. The temperatures were not high enough to cause weakening of the steel framing. Thermal expansion did not result in a loss of support for the beams and girders. And the collapse of this building was a global failure involving what? The near simultaneous failure of all of its columns. Wasn't a progressive collapse as claimed by NIST. So completely opposite findings, which corroborate all the witnesses and the evidence that we've not only looked at so far, but now we're going to take a deeper dive into find out how this building really came down by looking at the evidence of extreme heat, which is documented nowhere better than in FEMA's report, the Building Performance Assessment Team report that came out in Appendix C in 2002. It's a metallurgical examination of the actual steel. Only 0.001% of this steel was saved. These are among those pieces. What did they find? Never before observed eutectic reactions involving causing intergranular melting, turning a solid steel girder into Swiss cheese, like we see in this piece of World Trade Center 7 steel. Fires don't do this to steel. They don't melt steel, not office fires, especially those office fires. We have a rapid oxidation, sulfidation, meaning thermate was involved with sulfur added. Liquid iron and sulfur formed during this hot corrosion attack on the steel. This is incredible. In fact, New York Times says it's perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. Yet it's completely ignored by NIST. In fact, not only ignored, they threw this report out of their report before they published it in 2008. FEMA published theirs in 2002, completely omitted from the NIST report. The presence of sulfur is a damning element because there's no explanation, no rational explanation. NIST says, well, there might have been sulfur in the gypsum board. Well, wait a minute. Gypsum board has been used for 100 years to protect the steel. It's never turned around and attacked the steel that it's designed to protect. No, this is inert sulfur. It's chemically bound. In fact, the author, Jonathan Barnett, says steel members in the debris pile appear to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures. Well, there's a problem with that. It takes 4,000 degrees to evaporate steel, 3,000 degrees to begin to melt it. The temperatures in these office fires are only about 500 or 600 degrees, which is fairly typical. NIST claims over 1,000 degrees, but even so, you're 25% of the temperatures needed to evaporate steel. And yet it's documented here by structural engineer Abulhazen Nastani Azal, who had a National Science Foundation grant to study the steel. He doesn't know how it got evaporated. Well, we can see from the material picked up at the World Trade Center by the crab claw excavators, that the temperature of this molten material is exceeding 2,500 degrees. We know that because the color of molten steel and iron reveal its temperature. That's just the physics of it. So exceeding 2,500 degrees, this is completely unaccountable for in the official narrative. And even jet fuel, which of course no plane hit Building 7, but in the Twin Towers, the jet fuel only burns about 600 degrees Fahrenheit in open air, according to its manufacturer, ME Petroleum. So we have to ask ourselves, what can produce these temperatures? Well, let's go a little deeper.
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited, sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel.
Okay, so maybe we're getting somewhere, because if thermite were used, it would explain the extreme temperatures up to 4,000 degrees. It would explain the presence, the sulfur, which is added to thermite to become thermate, much more effective at cutting through steel. And it would explain the presence of ignited incendiaries, the proof of ignited incendiaries found by the U.S. Geological Survey in all of their dust samples that they studied and reported on in 2005 in their Particle Atlas of the World Trade Center dust. What did they find? Billions of what? Previously molten, that's exceeding 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Iron, that's the byproduct of thermite, molten iron, one of the two byproducts. And spherical, we'll come back to how these are spherical. This is pretty amazing. Up to 6% of these dust samples are composed of previously molten iron microspheres, about 4 tons altogether. They don't know where they came from. The EPA doesn't know where they came from, but they say this is a signature component of the World Trade Center dust. It's used to distinguish WTC dust from common office building dust. Well, wow. RJ Lee Group, an environmental consulting firm, finds the same thing. They say, well, these are formed during the event, not before, by the iron workers putting the building together, not afterward, by the iron workers taking the building apart, but during the event. Well, they know this because these samples, some of them are found far away from the World Trade Center. So it's inherent in the dust, the clouds of pulverized concrete itself. Well, an experiment, which is the arbiter of competing hypotheses, can let us know what thermite does when it's lit. And it's hard to light. It takes about 4,000 degrees. So it's not going to be lit by office fires. Well, they look like sparks, but they cool and they fall in the pan. And these are previously molten iron microspheres. How do they get spherical? Well, that's just what aerosolized liquids do, or molten iron under pressure by surface tension. That's what raindrops are. Surface tension forms them into spheres. Could that be what's responsible for the toasting of the tops of these cars? Falling molten iron droplets. What else in the official narrative can possibly explain the toasting of the tops of these cars in this very high heat event? And is there any evidence of unignited thermite in the World Trade Center dust? Well, a team of 8 international scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen does some deep analysis of these samples, and they find curious red-gray chips that are attracted by a magnet. So this is not primer paint. It has a very, very high iron content, which comprises about 75% of thermite, iron oxide. And so they're attracted by a magnet, and this gets their curiosity up, and they study the red layer quite intensively. And what they find is iron oxide, certainly, and aluminum. So the ingredients of thermite, 3/4 iron oxide and 1/4 aluminum. They go, wow, what's the signature of thermite doing in these dual-layered red-gray chips? Dual-layered indicating that they're fluid applied, right? Like paint. Well, they get real curious and do analysis again with XEDS, finding, yes, this is aluminum, elemental aluminum, the key ingredient of thermite in here as well. They zoom in 50,000 times with an electron microscope. And what do they find? Nano-sized particles of iron oxide and aluminum platelets. These are 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. This is highly engineered material set in a bed, a matrix of oxygen, silica, and carbon. What could that indicate? Well, organic material is used in TNT to expand rapidly and produce massive gas expansion, which in explosives knocks things over, whereas incendiaries like thermite work by means of heat. They burn things up at 4,000 degrees. So what have we got here? We've got an incendiary that's been engineered to become more explosive. This is documented very well by Lawrence Livermore Lab prior to 2001 and after. And they call it super thermite, explosive composites based on thermite reactions, intimately mixed at the nanometer size scale. You see, when you get these particles so small like that, the surface volume increases exponentially and the chemical reaction is virtually instantaneous. So they actually published the results of this in a differential scanning calorimeter at Lawrence Livermore Lab. And what do they find? They find that they ignite at about 420 Celsius, about 850 Fahrenheit. Well, that's exactly what these chips do that were found in the World Trade Center dust, proving that this is an exothermic reaction, not paint. Paint doesn't have all of these exotic properties. So we have something else. When they ignite, what do they produce? They produce molten iron microspheres with the same chemical reaction as the molten iron microspheres found and documented by R.J. Lee Group and the U.S. Geological Survey. So we know exactly where all of these unknown molten iron microspheres came from. They came from these red-gray chips, as if we didn't know. They're found attached to partially ignited red-gray chips, as you see here and here. And so this is extremely sophisticated material, not made in a cave in Afghanistan. This is made only in the most advanced, sophisticated defense contracting laboratories. And so with a real investigation, we can get to the heart of what really brought down not only Building 7, but the Twin Towers, as we'll see in a moment. The group produces in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal a 25-page peer-reviewed paper documenting that the red layer is active, unreacted, thermitic material incorporating nanotechnology. It's a highly energetic pyrotechnic or explosive material. It has all of these different properties. So they're covering their bases here. So there's a lot of unknowns still. But what is known? The 10 key characteristic features of controlled demolition, as well as some very uncharacteristic features, of course, with the use of incendiaries. This is direct evidence of the use of incendiaries. And particularly incendiaries in case of Building 7, we'll get to the explosive nature of the Twin Towers collapse in a moment. Fire doesn't cause any of these features, let alone all of them, with additional circumstantial evidence and eyewitness testimony. This becomes proof of controlled demolition, a body of proof that's convinced 3,600 architects and engineers to demand a new investigation. And they are seen on our website, a copy of that petition at richardgage911.org. And many of them appear in the forthcoming film series, 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom, which we're involved in post-editing right now. And people can help us get this film out, and by simply supporting, co-producing the film, again, at richardgage911.org. It's really important. This is going straight to a special grand jury, well, through a federal judge whom we will be giving it to accompany the 60 exhibits of testimony from these first responders and other peer-reviewed papers that we've been looking at, for instance. And the film is in the context of a grand jury boardroom providing this evidence by litigation director Mick Harrison and myself, representing the experts, 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, controlled demolition experts, all going to the grand jury. So join us in making that happen this summer by co-producing that film. Because if Building 7 has the features of controlled demolition, and we've shown many, many more than is necessary to provide overwhelming, irrefutable scientific forensic evidence of its controlled demolition, then we have to ask ourselves, is it possible that that happened at the World Trade Center as well? Well, just look at it. Both of the towers here coming down simultaneously. They were 15 minutes apart in reality. We have upward, outward, arching streamers, a geometry of fireworks, freely flying structural steel sections ejected laterally out of the towers, landing 600 feet in every direction, trailed by thick white smoke clouds. Wait a minute. Structural steel sections are not flammable in office fire or jet fuel conditions. Again, jet fuel burning only 600 degrees Fahrenheit in open air. So the ends of these beams are on fire. What caused that fire? Well, again, thermite is the incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And aluminum oxide ash is the second byproduct of thermite. And you're seeing that in action right here. And we'll take some close-up looks. But first, let's see if building 1 and 2, the north and south towers, have any of the evidence of controlled demolition. Let's begin with a sudden onset. Is there one? Well, the north tower is standing still, and all of a sudden, it's in uniform downward motion, not even jolting or hesitation, when the cold, hard, intact steel below is meeting this falling section above. Same at the south tower. It's in uniform. It's still, and all of a sudden, it's in uniform downward motion. Now, here's the official narrative. We're told that the upper part of the building drives the rest of the building down to the ground after the weakening of structural steel, and then destroys itself. This is called the crush down, crush up theory. It was produced by Zdeněk Bezant from Northwestern University in Chicago. And it remains the key theoretical basis. This extremely obfuscated paper survived scrutiny by structural engineers because they didn't understand it. This guy is the mathematical wizard at Northwestern University. And he submitted this paper just 2 days after 9/11. The rest of us were in shock, right? When's the next plane coming? When's the next attack? Who's doing this to us? And this guy, he's in his den cranking out the paper that became NIST's proof of their, they call it their column failure theory, or a pile driver theory, or a, some call it a pancaking collapse. And in any of those scenarios, they suffer from Newton's third law of motion. There's an equal and opposite destructive force when two bodies collide, right? Take a Mack truck and a Volkswagen. They destroy an equal part of each other. The Volkswagen will be destroyed before it gets past the bumper or the engine of the Mack truck, right? Does it matter if we drop the Volkswagen onto the Mack truck? No. The lightest part of a structure cannot possibly destroy the cold, hard, heavier, intact structural steel below. These are virtual pyramids, these buildings. They're light on the top with very light columns, which get, as we go down, heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier until mid-height, we're 30 inches by 16 inches, 2 inches thick at mid-height. And then they get heavier and heavier and heavier until the bottom, they're almost totally steel, solid steel, 52 inches by 22 inches. So let's just ask ourselves then, what is happening? If the top part can't destroy the lower part, let's take a look. Is it destroying the lower part, or is it destroying itself? I'll make it easier for you. Watch the lower red line, which is the bottom part of the upper section. It's not driving the rest of the building down. It's telescoping in on itself. It's being destroyed, just like the Volkswagen would be. But by what? An internal series of explosions, which we will be hearing 186 witnesses of. But if it were driving the rest of the building down to the ground, we would see it. But none of the photos, none of the videos show an upper part of the section, upper section driving the rest of the building down to the ground. No, it's completely gone after 3 seconds. After that, what do we see? Just like a volcanic eruption on the right, hint, hint, and building one of the Twin Towers on the left, with, again, upward, outward, arching streamers, a geometry of fireworks, freely flying, molten objects trailing thick white smoke clouds. Again, aluminum oxide ash, the byproduct of thermite, being responsible for the ejection of these solid components from the Twin Towers on the left. And if there were a pile driver driving the rest of the building down to the ground, it would have destroyed these few remaining columns that stand 1,000 feet in the air for 6 seconds following the destruction of the tower. But then it receives another explosive element, shaking the dust off of it and taking the knees out from underneath it. And then you see it descending frame by frame straight down through the dust that's been shaken off of it. So it's a lie. And it took engineers 10 years to decode this lie. And one of them is John Cole, who decodes it simply by providing a diagram that's real, that shows the spire, it's called, of core columns standing 1,000 feet in the air. In other words, the building is blowing out around the core columns, and it failed to take out these few remaining core columns. So there's an official report, 10,000 pages, $20 million spent by NIST, tasked by Congress to explain how and why World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 collapse. But again, obviously, failed miserably. So what could have brought down the towers? Let's listen to the experts. The oral histories of the first responders was created by Thomas von Essen, the fire commissioner of the FDNY. He wanted to record his first responders, and he did it within a month. Hundreds of them were recorded. And Graham McQueen, the late professor, recorded, read through all 12,000 pages of testimony and found 186 of them talking about what? Explosions and many flashes of light, many before the towers ever came down. We felt the ground shake. You could see the towers sway, and then it just came down. Again and again, you're going to hear the specific order of events. They're seeing, hearing, or feeling explosions before the tower collapses. All of a sudden, the ground just started shaking. It felt like a train running under my feet. The next thing we know, we look up and the tower is collapsing. It shook my bones. Shortly before the first tower came down, I remember feeling the ground shaking. I heard a terrible noise, and then debris just started flying everywhere. I saw a flash, flash, flash. The lower level of the building, you know, like when they demolish a building. With each popping sound, initially an orange and then a red flash came out of the building. And then it would just go all around the building on both sides. Saw a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. He saw about six of these brief flashes accompanied by a crackling sound before the tower collapsed. I saw low-level flashes. I saw flash, flash, flash. And then it looked like the building came down. You ever see professional demolition where they set charges on certain floors and then you hear the pop, pop, pop? When I heard that friggin' noise, that's when I saw the building coming down. An explosion appeared at the very top, simultaneously from all four sides. There seemed to be a momentary delay before you could see the beginning of the collapse. There was an explosion in the South Tower, one floor under another. When it hit about the fifth floor, I figured it was a bomb because it looked like a synchronized, deliberate kind of thing. Seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings, seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt. All these explosions. The building was blowing out on all four sides. We actually heard the pops. You know, you heard the pops of the building. I thought the terrorist planted explosive somewhere in the building. That's how loud it was. A crackling explosive. Another loud boom at the upper floors. Then there was a series of smaller explosions, which appeared to go completely around the building at the upper floors. And another loud, earth-shattering blast with a large fireball that blew out more debris. The lower level of the building, you know, like when they demolish a building, that's what I thought I saw. Do you see any flashes? He said, yes. I thought it was just me. He said, no, I saw them too. Everybody, I think, at that point still thought these things were blown up, so I was fully expecting anything else to blow up. You were there when the planes hit? No, I was there when the building exploded. You mean when it fell down? No, when it exploded. He knows what he saw. Feature number three. Is there a straight down symmetrical progression outside the building's footprint in this case? Well, let's take a look. We have the building beginning to tip over. In fact, it's tipping over the South Tower at 22 degrees. Well, how in the world then, with asymmetrical damage from the planes above, asymmetrical damage from the fires above, and asymmetrical loading on the building below by this part which is falling off, how in the world do we get complete symmetrical damage all the way around all four sides of the building, just like the first responders described? In fact, we can zoom in on the leading corner of these explosions and ask ourselves, what are we really seeing here? Are we seeing a collapse? This is 20 stories below the zone of destruction up above. which we're told is a collapse. I'm seeing individual pre-placed explosions, dozen of them, synchronistically timed. And we'll get to the isolated explosive ejection that you saw there in a moment. Well, right now, because that's exactly what we have. Not only just 20 stories down below, but 40 stories down below the zone of destruction. There's no accounting for these in the official narrative whatsoever, even 60 stories down below the zone of destruction. What can possibly account for these explosive, isolated explosive ejections, which in this close-up of the South Tower are going off simultaneously on the left side of the South Tower? And now we know why the South Tower loses its rigidity in its structural frame even before it falls off the building. It has no rigidity to maintain its angular momentum to fall off the building. So it's being essentially liquefied, the structure inside, by these explosions, which you see the evidence of on the left side, all at once, which can begin to explain how this building is falling so fast. In fact, David Chandler, physics teacher, identifies that it's falling at 64% of gravity. That's almost as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky, almost free fall. It's acceleration. It's getting faster and faster every second. It's not slowing down. It's not decelerating when the upper part meets the cold, hard, intact steel below, indicating that 90% of that steel had to have been removed. So only 10% of the structure's left, which is why it can fall darn near 2/3 of free fall acceleration. Through what? Through 80,000 tons of structural steel beneath the point of plane impacts, almost solid steel on the exterior. There's more steel than glass on the exterior of these buildings. There are Varandale truss, extremely rigid, an orthogonal truss made out of the columns marching every 3 feet, 4 inches all the way around the building, supported together by these horizontal spandrels at every floor. It's an incredible structure, 47 massive core columns, altogether 240 steel perimeter columns. It should not have come down like it was nothing. But we can tell how it came down by looking at the steel itself. What is it doing? It's being laterally ejected, impaling themselves in surrounding skyscrapers all around, destroying the Winter Garden 600 feet away, hurled by a force which we can readily identify through deduction that it is an explosive force in this case, in the Twin Towers, very explosive, hurling these 4- and 8-ton structural steel sections laterally, like this one, landing 600 feet in every direction, back to, forward to. This is a 4-ton structural steel section laterally ejected, impacting the building 7, 300 feet away, trailed by what? Steel is not flammable again. Thermite charges on steel would render it the object of the chemical reaction of thermite, the byproduct of which is molten iron and aluminum oxide. You got to get that in order to understand what's going on here. In addition, there's enough explosive force to hurl a 200-pound cannonball 3 miles. And there's hundreds and hundreds of these exterior structural sections delivered up to 1,200 to 1,400 foot, actually, in diameter, all around the World Trade Center, extending beyond the World Trade Center, impacting, in fact, WTC-7, which again, NIST says is not a significant factor in the initiation of that collapse. And by the way, if 100,000 tons of steel framing is distributed outside the footprint, what's crushing the building? The steel is easily 3/4 of the weight of this building. It's been delivered up to 600 feet in every direction. It's not available to crush the building. It's not found in the perimeter down below. Maybe it was the concrete. Let's look and see. Because there were 110 floors of 4- and 8-inch thick concrete, each an acre in size. The concrete was poured on metal decking supported by lightweight steel trusses spanning up to 60 feet. Where are they? 110 acre size floors of concrete. We should have seen them stacked like pancakes at the bottom, but we don't see pancakes. We see a 4- or 6-story pile of miscellaneous perimeter columns, some core columns, miscellaneous metal. We don't see 50 concrete floors. We don't see 20. We don't see 10. We don't see 1 acre size floor. Where did they go? In a real pancaking collapse, like in this from this earthquake in Mexico, we see pancakes. Not so with the Twin Towers. The concrete is missing. Well, where did it go? Oh, there it is, pulverized in midair. All the photos, all the videos show the 90,000 tons of concrete pulverized to 100 micron particles on average, as documented in the dust studies. Now, how did that happen? That's an incredible degree of pulverization. And where did that concrete go? Laterally across lower Manhattan in these clouds of pulverized concrete, landing up to from river to river in a 3-square-mile area in this blanket 3 inches thick. Well, if that's true, and it is, how could that concrete be crushing the building? That's most of the rest of the weight of this building, more than 1/4 of the building. So you probably have 7/8 of the weight of this building between the steel and the concrete. So it wasn't the steel, and it's not the concrete. And yet all of that weight was used as a mass to crush this building in Zdenek Bazant's fraudulent theory that remains NIST's theory today. Well, let's look at that analysis, because it took engineers 10 years to decode it. And when they did, they found that NIST fraudulently doubled the mass up above, not just used the weight of the concrete and the steel, but doubled it. And he decreased the column strength below to support that by 3 times. He decreased it. This is complete fraud. The entire calculation was rigged in favor of a collapse by Chicago, by Northwestern University in Chicago. So these errors were highlighted and published, well, submitted for publishing by engineers like Tony Zambodi, Richard Johns, Gregory Zutolinski. And yet their papers, particularly this one, the American Society of Civil Engineers would not publish them. Why? Out of scope, they said, simply without any explanation. How is that out of scope to cite the errors in a previously published paper in that journal, Journal of Engineering Mechanics? So this is an ethical complaint that's turning into a legal issue by the authors of these papers, still without resolution. How might the perpetrators, the real perpetrators, have gotten access to the building? Turns out there was a fireproofing upgrade in the years before 9/11. And coincidentally, certain blocks of these floors were the same blocks of floors that the airplanes hit. Well, that's fascinating. This was developed by Kevin Ryan in his blog, digwithin.net. Take a look at it, because it's a lot deeper than just this. Very informative. How could explosives be placed without the building occupants knowing? Well, that's one possibility, right? Fireproofing upgrade, plausible. Liquid applied. Fireproofing is a one of the methods they use for fireproofing. It's called intumescent paint. Perhaps under the guise of that, perhaps under the guise of an elevator modernization, where the core columns could easily be accessible from the elevators. The hoistways house the cabs, and the hoistways are composed of a couple of inches of gypsum board. Well, turns out we had the largest elevator modernization in the world going on the 9 months prior to 9/11. Why would the Port Authority have given one of the largest, most sophisticated elevator modernization programs in the industry's history to who? Ace Elevator, a small maintenance contractor with basically only one customer. Some believe that this elevator modernization was yet another covert operation, giving operatives access to the core columns and beams in the building. Yes, all the ACE elevator employees, 85 of them, are accounted for and safe. Why? Because there was a labor dispute that day in that time frame, and the members of that company, about 50 of them, were pulled out to a union meeting to discuss some business. So they were not impacted, nor did they help the firefighters rescue the victims. These are the experts in the elevator operation, right? So let's look at the disposition of the steel, 180,000 tons of it all together. In easily the largest and most perplexing structural failures in history, we have 400 truckloads per day lined up to remove this steel, starting just 2 weeks after 9/11, in the case of Building 7. The forensic evidence was shipped to China for recycling before investigators could do a proper forensic examination. This is the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene, prompting Bill Manning, editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering magazine, to cry out, "Crucial evidence that could answer many questions is on the slow boat to China," showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately. But it didn't. And now you can begin to get a sense of why, regarding the Twin Towers, we also have more than 3,600 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation. Again, many of whom will appear in our documentary, 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom, an unprecedented film series taking hard evidence of 9/11 crimes to court. And that accompanies the other documentaries that we've made, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out, which is available on the website, and the movie 7, made by Dylan Avery, about the University of Alaska report on Building 7's structure. And with Professor Halsey. And then actor Ed Asner narrating the finest, shortest film on Building 7, 15 minutes, solving the mystery of World Trade Center 7. The outline of all of this evidence is available on our website, richardgage911.org. And you can purchase these and hand them out. You can download and print them. Download them for free and print them if you want. We got to get to the bottom of this story. I mean, after all, $6.4 trillion have been spent now on the global war on terror, which started as a result of what? 9/11. The key components of which were what? The Twin Towers destruction. So a fraudulent cause has created wars that have in which we've invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, killing millions of people, at least a couple of million. They've documented 800,000 lives in those wars. The longest war in U.S. history, Afghanistan, $14 trillion altogether in that war. The post 9/11 war is another $8 trillion. And the ensuing policies, like the loss of our civil liberties through the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, in which any of us can be arrested without a right to a lawyer, a trial, a jury. We can be tortured and even assassinated, all because of the use of force, which is not even defined, or association with terrorism, which is not even defined. So we got a real problem, right? Torture now is we've been stained by the adoption of these illegal methods, which they call legal. The Homeland Security has been brought in to contain, corral, and control the other intelligence agencies, as if that were possible. We have an emerging police state where our texts, our emails, our phone calls are currently systematically swept up and stored for use against us later. Completely unconstitutional. But because of an emergency, not unlike the last 3 years, emergency that we've been suffering under, for which they also had a solution, a false solution to a false problem, which we've documented very well, the parallels between those sets of events and 9/11 on our website. So yeah, we have huge problems in our country, and the truth about 9/11 is a very dark one. So you got to ask yourself, where do you, our viewing audience, draw your line in the sand? Do you wait for the next 9/11? Well, I'll give you the sad news. It happened over the last 3 years, and it's happening again in Gaza. The parallels between 9/11 and Gaza are even more extraordinary than those of the last 3 years. And that's also found on our website, richardgage911.org. So join me and join Jay in speaking out the truth wherever you find it and however you can and are called to put it out, because we have a collective power. We are not alone. Look at what we can do when working together. We may be a domino, a millimeter in size.
Boom.
But collectively.
That was 13 dominoes. If I had 29 dominoes, the last domino would be as tall as the Empire State Building.
And that's what we're up against. We're up against a level of evil embodying itself in the deep state, taking over positions in government and finance and economy and geostrategically, military, and lying to all of us about all of these false flag operations. It's time to wake up and smell the roses, folks. It's not too late yet. We can still speak out and It is happening. There is an awakening here. And this is one of Jay's top imperatives, that we not only realize our own need to wake up, but that we join collectively many, many others in waking the rest of us up. Right, Jay?
Couldn't agree more, Richard. That was a fantastic presentation. I think it's impossible to ignore all of the data points when you put them together like this. When it comes to the motives, there are a lot of ideas given. The missing $2.3 trillion in the Pentagon's defense budget, the Project for a New American Century, and the subsequent Middle Eastern invasion, as you mentioned. Have you given much thought and investigation towards the potential motives behind the attacks?
Well, one thing you can do is follow the money, the classic. And somebody who did just that is James Corbett. He documents not only the massive level of bonds that were due the day of 9/11 that didn't have to be repaid, that were used by the deep state to take down the Russia. But we have the gas pipeline that was slated to go through Afghanistan, and the Taliban was resisting that because UNICAL had imposed a delay, and so the Taliban was working with a Brazilian oil company instead. And so we couldn't have that. So the plans for Afghanistan were actually signed the day before 9/11. This was not a surprise to anybody, 9/11. And so we have the oil in Iraq, which has been documented by numerous journalists, is now in the hands of foreign firms, whereas Saddam Hussein had nationalized the oil. Well, we weren't in there for weapons of mass destruction. We weren't in there for ties to Osama bin Laden with Saddam Hussein. So, yeah, what was it? Oil and gas go a long way to explain that mystery. We also have the strategic locations of Iraq and Afghanistan on each side of Iran, the mortal enemy of Israel, whose foreign policy seems to be intermixed with our own. So that's a subject I go deep into in Gaza, the parallels, the astounding parallels with 9/11.
I do remember coming across the Project for a New American Century document when I was initially looking into, you know, these alternative ideas around 9/11. And it's striking. I mean, it's quite a dense document if people haven't read through it. But what it outlines, and this is a neocon, you know, think tank that's comprised of essentially the same people that were in the Bush administration. They outline the need for a geostrategic footprint in the Middle East, a multi-theater campaign in the Middle East, and that you wouldn't be able to get the American people to fall in line with this absent a catalyzing event like, quotation, a new Pearl Harbor.
That's exactly what Bush put in his diary. Today we had our new Pearl Harbor.
So, I mean, this is another thing that's probably worth talking about. You know, do we need to talk about mass formation psychosis? It's extremely clear that the official narrative surrounding these events is preposterous, and yet so many still believe the official narratives. Now, I can understand the shock factor at the time and being easily led into believing the government message, a bit like we've had over the last few years, you know, that instantaneous shock and awe, people very quickly go into alignment with the collective decision. But over time, you are supposed to kind of start looking around and sober up from that initial hysteria. So why do you think people are still so resistant to 9/11 when we've had documentaries, we've had investigations, people know that there's alternatives, but there's still a lot of denial around it?
Well, I would suggest that half the people have heard the word conspiracy theory and rejected it around 9/11. But if that half of the American and world public could actually see this presentation, and all of you, Jay's followers, if you can send this out to everybody, we can be like the little domino that turns into the big domino, right? There's an incredible effect when things go viral. People begin to wake up. Yes, we've got to have this awakening out of our slumber, out of our shock. People don't know the information. Now, why do they reject it out of hand? Those that do, they can't afford to realize that we've been duped on a massive scale. I mean, all of the media, the mainstream media, which is owned by 95% of which is owned by just five corporations who also own the military industrial complex and half of the rest of our economy. This is an incredible insurgency that we don't want to believe. We don't want to believe that all 435 of our Congress members, almost all of them, have been bribed or blackmailed or could be so ignorant. We cannot accept that level of conspiracy. It's just like the last 3 years. We can't accept, you know, that every hospital is touting the official narrative. We can't accept that they would offer something that's not safe and not effective. So, and far worse than that, if you look at the parallels of that set of events on the website, Richard Gage 9/11, we need to be safe in this world. And particularly women who are designed to be nesters for the most part. I lost my marriage over this issue and my previous marriage. And it was all around. She didn't disagree with what I was saying or the evidence I was showing, but she couldn't live with this this terrible message day to day. It makes most people feel quite unsafe. For me, I got real angry. I mean, really angry that I personally had been lied to. I swallowed this lie. What did Mark Twain say? It's easier to fool people than to convince them that they've been fooled. And that is so true. It's a cognitive dissonance that we go into. We just reject it out of hand partly because, like you said, that original shock on the morning of 9/11, it took us, most of us, into an infantile state of mind where we just needed answers. We needed to be safe again. We accepted the answers. Yeah, this is a collapse, a series of collapses, even though it's obviously two buildings being blown apart. I accepted it for 5 years. I didn't really accept it. I just put it off. I did not want anything to do with it. The first I had ever heard of an alternative theory was 5 years later. And I'm suggesting that most people haven't heard this information. Once I get people into a room, and I've spoken 700 times in rooms from 10 people to 4,000 people, I'll always do a show of hands. How many of you agree these are controlled demolitions and we need a new investigation? Almost all the hands go up. Whereas before, because I asked them before and after, we have quite a few people still agreeing with the official narrative. So it's just a matter. It's two matters. One, getting the information in front of them. And two, crossing your fingers that they can overcome their own personal cognitive dissonance. I don't have the magic pill for that. There are people who specialize in that. And Christopher Gruner is one of them, and from Boston 9/11 Truth. And he can help people get past this initial shock so that they can wake up and be a productive part of enlightening humanity to the hell that we've been subjected to.